behalf of everyone at REG, I want to welcome you all and thank you so much for coming. This means a lot to everyone behind REG, so thank you very much. For anyone who I haven't met yet, which I think I have met you all, but I'm Lynn, and my job in the poker scene is, well, for the last 5 years it's been as a reporter and presenter. There's so many incredible people in this industry that really have a craving to give back, and that's why I'm inspired. Everyone is in such a great position to be able to give back, and so many people don't really, myself included, understand completely how to give back in the most effective way to make the biggest positive impact on the world. And so what I love about REG and the people behind it is that you've all dedicated yourselves to help educate everyone to really give back in the most effective way, and I think that's really special. So I'm going to introduce Adriano, who is one of the board members of REG, and he's going to explain the basis of behind it, all behind it.
Thanks for the introduction, Lynn. My name's Adriano Mannino. I'm a REG board member, and I'm also the co-president of GBF Switzerland, stands for Giordano Bruno Foundation Switzerland, which is a foundation that promotes effective giving and effective altruism in Switzerland. I'm going to speak about the background between Raising for Effective Giving, which is mainly using science and rational decision-making to help as many people in need as possible. Here's the outline of the talk. I'm going to briefly speak about rational decision-making in general, then as applied to the world at large. Furthermore, cost-effective charity more specifically, then extending that rational career choice and life path, and last but not least, a few words on what REG will be about very concretely. So let's start out with rationality. Well, basically, rationality is about acting so as to maximize our expected goal achievement. So it pays for everyone to be rational, because everyone has goals, and rationality, rational action, decision-making is just about best expected goal achievement. It's important here to note that the concept of rationality is goal neutral. So many people associate rationality with certain goals and contents, such as, you know, emotional coldness or selfishness even, but that's totally not in line with the standard definition of rationality in cognitive science and also philosophy. Rationality is goal neutral, and in economics too, of course. It's just about best, optimal, expected goal achievement, whatever these goals are. Recently, there have been a number of popular books. Of course, you know, there's a whole science behind it, behavioral economics, cognitive science, philosophy, that's been going on for decades. But a number of recent popular books have come out on the subject. For instance, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winning psychologist. He has documented tons of biases, and a bias is a systematically irrational pattern affecting our decisions. He has documented loads of them, and shown how we systematically, predictably act irrationally in our everyday lives. Then another book in this line is Taleb's Black Swan, and yet another one, Dan Ariely's Predictably Irrational. I can really recommend these formidable introductions to rational decision making. Also, when you go to Wikipedia and check out the list of cognitive biases, it's really long. Never ends, dozens, hundreds of entries there for cognitive biases. So this really proves that human cognition, human decision-making, unfortunately, is full of biases, full of irrationality. So that's bad news on the one hand. But on the other hand, it's also good news, because it means that there's a lot of room for improvement. That's a screenshot from the REG website, reg-charity.org. We also speak about the number of biases, how they affect charity, and how they are also relevant in poker. So a few of them listed here: availability heuristic, base rate neglect, confirmation bias, down to overconfidence bias. Overconfidence bias, an example here, people systematically overestimate their own competence and also their own ability to make predictions. For instance, if you ask people to evaluate their sort of relative ability as drivers, how good a driver are you? An overwhelming majority of people will say, well, for sure I'm better than the median driver. a result that doesn't make a whole lot of statistical sense, but still you obtain it when you ask people. They're all better than the median driver. Then there's a status quo bias, for instance, also well documented, our tendency to systematically favor the status quo, even if it's worse than a changing option. And this can affect our life and death decisions and be really serious. So for instance, an example from medicine, status quo bias would be where people, for instance, prefer the medication that they have been given first to another medication they could change to, just because it's the status quo. You're now with your first medication, you could easily change, but you don't, because you're systematically biased towards the status quo, even though a change might have been life-saving. Now, when we're talking life and death decisions, we can extend that to decisions regarding the world at large. And these decisions, not just, you know, regarding your own person as an individual, regarding the world at large, may be much worse or much more important still, because the world, of course, contains many more individuals than just one. So that's part two of the talk, rational decision-making as applied to decisions regarding the world at large. A good way of clarifying what our goals even are, and of course that's very important if you want to be rational, we need to know what our goals are, is to go through some relevant thought experiments. So imagine you walk past a lake or a pond and you realize that there's a child drowning in there. And you also realize that you're the only person with the ability to save that child. So the child's life really depends on your decision. But now there's a complication. I mean, you should now run in, walk in to the lake or the shallow pond. I mean, there's no danger whatsoever to you. But you've just bought a new expensive suit, you know, several thousand dollars, say $2,000 of clothing and shoes. So the complication is by walking in and saving that child, that human life, you will ruin your clothes and your shoes. And these $2,000 will be gone. There will be no replacement. You'll just have to rebuy. So basically, you can save a human life by sacrificing $2,000. Would you do it? Would you hesitate? It's interesting. I mean, when you ask people about what their goals are, many will first, you know, state something rather selfish, my own happiness, for instance. And some of them will even come out straight and say, yeah, I'm an egoist, I just care about myself. But when you then put them into such a thought experimental situation, most of them would actually not hesitate and say, yeah, of course, you know, I'd walk in because to me, a human life counts more than, you know, some clothing. And that would already prove that they are not, that they were wrong in thinking that they actually only had selfish, egoistic goals. But if we analyze this decisional situation a bit more precisely, so a decision is always a choice between options, of course, or between worlds and future world courses. And here you can choose between option one and option two, where option one includes you have $2,000 more with which maybe to buy some additional luxury goods, and a child suffers and dies. That's option one, world one, that you could choose. Or option two, you could go for a world where you have $2,000 less, but a child survives and lives happily. Now, most people here, as psychological studies also bear out, would go for option two, with the reasoning that, you know, according to their own goals, their own utility function, as it were, a child's life matters more than $2,000. And so the rational decision is, of course, to walk in, sacrifice the clothing, the money, and save the life. But now what's very interesting is that psychology has also documented a very strong distance bias that we have. So when you ask people about the situation where they are, you know, in a disaster, disaster is taking place, natural disaster, and they are given the ability to spend significant amounts of money on saving lives. Would you do it? Would you not do it? 70% say, yeah, of course I would. But then when you slightly modify the situation and say, well, suppose you're sitting at home on the couch and you only know that such a catastrophe is going on through TV, say, or through a friend that's at the site of the disaster. You see the pics, you see the videos. Would you still be willing to sacrifice significant amounts of money in order to save lives? And here, you know, the rate drops significantly. Only 35% of people would be willing to do that. But can that be rational? Or isn't that just, you know, a blatantly irrational bias that people have here? Now, smart people might come up with the following rationalization. Well, maybe it works. Maybe it is rational, not just a rationalization. They could say, well, what my real decisional goal is just removing the unpleasant feeling that I get from being at the site of the disaster and not helping. And this could, of course, then make a rational distinction between the two cases. You get the unpleasant feeling when at the site of the disaster, therefore it's rational to then help. You don't get it when sitting on the couch at home. But I'm not sure this reply really works, because is that really what's going on when we're willing to help at the site of the disaster? Are we really saying that we're never, not even at the site of the disaster, helping others for their own sake? And it's all just, you know, because we feel bad? If that were the case, then, you know, one could go through an additional thought experiment. Namely, suppose that at the site of the disaster, you were offered an advanced medical pill that instantly removed all unpleasant feelings that you were experiencing for free. Then the rational decision here would be to just take that pill instead of removing the feeling by giving $2,000 away. A totally selfish person would still walk through that and say, yeah, that's what's going on. But I think that's generally implausible. So generally, it seems that most humans really also have as an important part of their goal, helping others for their own sake. Or if that's not what we're going to say, then, as I said, we need to take this advanced medical pill in that situation, which seems utterly implausible. So that's for one and two. Now, more specifically, to cost-effective charity. If, as we've seen, we are interested in spending at least a portion of our resources on helping others for their own sake, then the question, of course, is, well, what should we optimally spend it on in order to maximize the number of people saved? And that's, of course, an empirical, a scientific question. So many people, when considering that question, would say, I'm just going to go by my intuition, by my gut feeling. I'm just going to pick basically a charity that's close to my heart, that convinces me intuitively. But that probably seems an unwise approach, because remember Wikipedia's big, long list of cognitive biases? These are all irrational patterns that show how our intuition, our gut feelings are systematically wrong and how it pays, you know, to reason more formally, to calculate more explicitly. So it's probably bad advice to just rely on intuition. And here, because it's an empirical scientific question, we should indeed look at the data. We should look at scientific studies, at RCTs, randomized control trials that have been done about the worst causes of suffering and their possible remedial interventions. And so here's an example of a so-called meta-charity. GiveWell, givewell.org, that's a bunch of people with backgrounds in the quantitative sciences, economists, mathematicians, people from the business world, hedge fund managers, that at some point said, well, we've acquired really good quantitative skills. Why not apply these skills to improving the world, to charity? And what they've done is they went through hundreds, literally hundreds of charities and evaluated them scientifically. So they gathered data and then made cost effectiveness estimates for every one of them. And as a result, they come up with a few recommendations. So many people are rather pessimistic about charities, you know, question whether they are effective or not, whether some might not be straight out ineffective and counterproductive, and that's indeed true. But for the donation argument, what's required is that there be at least some charities that are demonstrably scientifically effective, and organizations such as GiveWell can demonstrate just that. So as you can see, they only recommend very few charities. So these are all the review charities, and then just a small chunk of it, the top charities. But these are really, really demonstrably effective and really do save lives. So some basic research results. For instance, don't look at overhead ratio or CEO salaries. So overhead ratio refers to administrative costs. Imagine a business, a company advertised with a slogan like 90% of your dollar goes directly into building cars. Only 10% goes into planning and designing them with paid staff. That would be totally ridiculous and obviously bad, suboptimal business model. But in the charity sector, in the charity world, that's what people advertise their organizations with. 90% of your dollar goes directly to the people, helps them directly. But why would anyone believe this should be the most cost-effective charity model? We're not interested in how much money as a relative fraction goes into the administration. And indeed, you know, a better administration and better planning, paid staff, instead of just relying on volunteers. Why would one rely on volunteers? Could also increase the overall impact. So the figure we're interested in is output per input unit, cost effectiveness, and not overhead ratio. But still, in the charity world, almost everybody is interested in overhead ratio. And that seems to be a systematic bias there. Another upshot is just do the math, because it really pays big time to look into the data. It turns out that charities vary greatly, enormously, in terms of cost effectiveness, some being literally 100 or even 1,000 times more effective than others. And it's paradoxical, because, you know, where it matters the most, where real lives are on the line, people look into cost effectiveness the least. And we want to turn that on its head.
We have two rule books. We have one for the nonprofit sector and one for the rest of the economic world. It's an apartheid, and it discriminates against the nonprofit sector in five different areas, the first being compensation. So in the for-profit sector, the more value you produce, the more money you can make. But we don't like nonprofits to use money to incentivize people to produce more in social service. We have a visceral reaction to the idea that anyone would make very much money helping other people. Interesting that we don't have a visceral reaction to the notion that people would make a lot of money not helping other people. You know, you want to make $50 million selling violent video games to kids, go for it. We'll put you on the cover of Wired magazine, but you want to make $500,000 trying to cure kids of malaria and you're considered a parasite yourself.
Here's a more concrete example.
So suppose your goal is to get kids into school. There's so many things you could do. You could pay for a uniform, you could eliminate fees, you could build latrines, you could give girls sanitary pads, etc., etc. So what's the best? Well, at some level, we think all of these things should work. So is that sufficient? Like, if we think they should work intuitively, should we go for them? Well, in business, that's certainly not the way we would go about it. Suppose you have $100 to spend on various interventions. How many extra years of education do you get for your $100? Now I'm going to show you what we get with various education interventions. So the first one are, if you want, the usual suspect. Higher teachers, school meals, school uniforms, scholarships. That's not bad. For your $100, you get between 1 and 3 extra years of education. Things that don't work so well is bribing parents, just because so many kids are already going to school that you end up spending a lot of money. And here are the more surprising results. Tell people the benefits of education. That's very cheap to do. So for every $100 you spend doing that, you get 40 extra years of education. And in places where there are worms, intestinal worms, cure the kids of their worms. And for every $100, you get almost 30 extra years of education. So these are not your intuition. This is not what people would have gone for. And yet these are the programs that work. We need that kind of information. We need more of it. And we need it to guide policy.
Then this is a concrete example of a GiveWell top recommended charities, schistosomiasis control initiative. They do school-based schistosomiasis treatment and deworming. So they're focused on neglected tropical diseases. And a treatment per child per year just costs $0.50. And it protects a child for a whole year. So if you donate like $1,000, you can help 2,000 children. And that's really amazing. There's also a lot of room for more funding. That's always also an important consideration. Whether a charity has room for more funding, several million here. Very high transparency and commitment to self-evaluation. That's, of course, also a core principle if you want to be effective. Transparency and self-evaluation. And there are positive flow-through effects. So, for instance, the children that were dewormed, it doesn't only help their health, it also helps education because they miss much fewer days at school. And you can then also track how they're doing after school. So the children, you can do that with RCTs too. The children that got the deworming treatment then earn much more. So there are flow-on effects that benefit the whole economy. Here's Phil, who went to Uganda to visit the organization and came back with some very nice pictures and the quote saying, "In Uganda, I can help 1,000 people with $2,000. In Germany, this will be hardly enough to really help even one person. To me, all humans are equal. That's why I support the projects which I think are most effective." And that's really, I think, crucial to realize that actually cost effectiveness in charity is a logical implication of all human lives counting for the same. Extending that, charity evaluators such as GiveWell are increasingly also looking into high-impact causes that are harder to quantify. and that go beyond world poverty. But if we take an impartial perspective and are impartially interested in making the world a better place and reducing as much unnecessary suffering as possible, then, for instance, you know, other domains that might come up are could be factory farming. Factory farming has never been as big as it currently is, and it affects billions of animals adversely, and that probably also causes a lot of suffering. So that might be another focus area. Then global cooperation and conflict avoidance also seems like a high-impact area, although policymaking is usually quite hard to quantify, but one can still try. Future technologies such as artificial intelligence, which don't yet exist but are foreseeable and may be super disruptive, so it might really be super important in terms of how the world goes in the long run to navigate technological transitions such as the one to artificial intelligence well, rationally and benevolently. And then what one calls meta-charity, so you go one level up and focus, for instance, on research. So you do research about research. How cost-effective is research? I mean, if, for instance, the GiveWell charity evaluators didn't exist, then we wouldn't have a good basis for comparing different charities. So that's also extremely high leverage and extremely high impact to do research, go one level up. Or fundraising. Indeed, maybe instead of donating directly to the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, you may do fundraising for these projects and multiply the amount of money donated. Or movement building. One could, instead of using the money to donate directly, donate to a meta-charity, a meta-organization that just spreads the word about donating and maybe in the end gets many more people to donate, and much more money will then maybe be moved to the direct causes. Now that's already section 4, extending that further into rational career choice and life path. This is also scientifically developed currently, and you know, for starters, one can just try to categorize and classify the various career options that there are. Broadly, direct benefiter, moneymaker, researcher, and influencer. Now, if you're asking how many lives a direct benefiter, such as a doctor, you know, maybe a doctor in a developed country, that's sort of the standard example. When you ask people intuitively, what do you think is sort of a typical example of an especially charitable career? Well, why not doctor in a developing country? And then here also you can do basic quantification, try to quantify how many lives are being saved. But it's not so easy, because an important concept to consider here is replaceability. So when we're doing anything, we need to ask, well, would the thing that we're doing happen otherwise anyway if we were not doing it? So what would happen otherwise, counterfactually? If the same thing would happen anyway or be done by another person, then actually we're not having any impact, although we may have the illusion to have impact. So what would happen if that first person did not take up the job as a doctor? Well, then maybe another person would replace them. And maybe that other person would perform slightly worse. But again, you know, that just eats up a lot of the impact. And counterfactually, in the worst case, you're not having any impact as a doctor because your job would be done anyway. So that's an important thing to consider if you're really doing something irreplaceable. Now, let's move on to the second career path, moneymaker. Of course, one good thing about the moneymaker is that he or she can fund or pay for several doctors and multiply the impact through that. Especially when you fund the education of doctors in poorer countries. Another good thing is that the replaceability concern applies to a much lesser degree. Because, say, if you're a banker or a moneymaker in general and decide to donate a large chunk of what you earn to cost-effective charities, then usually you're not replaceable, because the person that would otherwise earn or take the money is, at least currently, quite unlikely to donate as much as you would, and then also to as cost-effective charities. The third career path that I want to consider is influencer. Well, what could an influencer do? Maybe influence several moneymakers to then donate a lot and really create an insane impact in the end. Does that imply that being an influencer is the best career? Not necessarily, because there's an influencer moneymaker regress. So as a moneymaker, you can also get behind the influencer and maybe pay for several influencers to do societal work, to write books, blogs, do public speaking and stuff. And you can also do both at the same time. Of course, you know, depending what sort of career you have, you can be a moneymaker and be very vocal about it and be an influencer at the same time. A big part of world improvement is, of course, self-improvement. As I said, rationality in general is about optimal goal achievement, and of course, it's you. You have to achieve the goals. And in charity also, this has an important application. I mean, there is this well-known saying, well, don't give them fish, teach them how to fish. Teach them how they can help themselves. That's usually more effective if you go one level up, if you go meta. And as applied to self-improvement, you know, if they give you fish, what do? You sell it and buy a fishing rod, probably, in order to improve skill. And other things you want to improve, of course, is, for instance, how you deal with procrastination and distractions that make you ineffective. And of course, staying healthy and happy is also super important, because that's what your productivity importantly depends on. And in fact, self-improvement, of course, you know, you can apply it in selfish context just for your own individual goals. But when at least a significant part of your life goal is altruistic, is helping other people as much as possible, then self-improvement may indeed also be regarded as a form of meta-charity. Because the more effective you are, the better you play your games and sub-games, and the more resources you can acquire, the more lives you will be able to save. But couldn't that amount to, you know, being a burden? Isn't charity a burden, especially, you know, if you take it more seriously? Well, I mean, I guess we are taking quite seriously, and if you take it seriously, it may take you to awesome dinners like this one, and so far this hasn't been so burdensome, but, I mean, maybe it's a valid concern. I think there are several replies to this concern. So the basic approach is one of rationality, of thinking about what my own goals are. And if I go through a thought experience such as the one with the drowning child, I realize that helping others and, you know, sacrificing financial resources that I don't really need is actually part of my goal. So I would fail to achieve my goals, my considered goals, if I did not donate as much to charity as I do. So it's about my goals, ultimately. And also, it often leads to optimized meaning in life. So, you know, having an overarching ultimate goal, such as reducing as much unnecessary suffering as possible, made my own daily sub-games and sub-goals that I'm inevitably paying also much more meaningful and gave me a real motivational boost. Because, you know, when you're pursuing stuff that you would do anyway, say earning money or whatever, talking to people, when you earn money, then it's no longer just about some additional chunk of money for yourself. But you know that there's also a dependence there, an additional dependence, namely the lives of hundreds, if not thousands of people may also depend now on your performance in your daily games that you're playing. Now, raising for effective giving specifically as a poker meta charity will be dedicated to growing the community of people with a mindset of strategic world improvement, rational charity, and effective giving. And to this end, we want to give to unusually cost-effective organizations. So we don't want to pick them at random or just go with our gut feelings and intuitions. We really want to rely on evidence, science, the studies available, and we want to give unusually large amounts. That's, of course, important for direct impact, but also for signaling reasons. We don't want to continue just the traditional forms of charity where, you know, it's more sort of pro forma, you're giving a bit to charity too. No, we want to really take this seriously. And now we went for a first baseline of 2% of winnings, but of course this can be taken further. And last but not least, we want to convey the message that life's a game, that losing sucks, and that therefore we should shoot for big wins for everyone. Thanks for your attention.